America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Recently, our guest on this podcast made news when he said on CBS that the gerontocracy running America needs to step aside and turn the wheel over to a new generation of leadership. He means in the White House and clearly in the House and the Senate. Take a look at the Senate. David Gergen should know. He's served at the behest of four presidents, three Republicans and one Democrat. His lessons on leadership in his new book are invaluable. You can hear his thoughts today only on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is David Gergen, a White House advisor to four presidents, bipartisan, Democrat and Republicans, and he's written a great book called Hearts Touched with Fire, How Great Leaders Are Made. And you have been at the beck and call of some great leaders, clearly. But I've got to ask you, while in the book you talk about how great leaders are made, I'm curious, as we start our conversation, what attributes are required to be a great and trusted advisor to presidents such as those that you have served?
Well, you hit the right word right in the beginning. That's trust. It makes such a difference whether the commander in chief knows that the people who work for him have his, not only are smart and wise, but they have his back. They're not playing games. They're not flashing knives at each other in the middle of the night. But they have their concentration is on the president and on what that administration, what that team can accomplish. I think that's one of the challenges facing the Biden administration now, and it's still in its early days after all. He started out extremely well, but he was on a roller coaster after that. And as we speak, he's doing well. I think he's doing pretty well in Ukraine. But believe me, he has a great deal of faith in the people around him, starting with Ron Klain, who is his chief of staff. So it does help, I think, to have a staff that is mixed in one sense, and that is some people have been around a long time, have gray hairs, and they bring some wisdom to the table, while there are other people who are younger who don't have the wisdom, but they have the energy and they have the imagination, and you bring that mix together, and I think you get a far better result in the White House than otherwise.
The whole notion of the great leader concept, as you go along in the book, you say that it's not necessarily something that scholars still really ascribe
yes.
to. And yet we do on the outside. We say, wow, look at Vladimir Zelensky now, for example, the everyman coming up into a realm that we never thought he was capable of. And we've seen it in movies. But have we seen someone like him come out of the dark in that sense to really shake our imaginations?
Well, Larry, that's an interesting question. I think the another improbable figure with some parallels and obviously some very big differences. But Ronald Reagan came out of the out of the entertainment world, and he had very little experience until he started giving speeches in politics, and that got him elected in California to be governor. So he did have the 8 years as governor, which made a big difference. But he essentially came up in Hollywood. I was with him in the last years of his life, and that's what he. When you talk about his, when you talked with him about his past, his nostalgia was for Hollywood, not for the White House.
You start the book talking about Greta Thunberg and the students' activism in the wake of the Parkland school shooting. And that suggests that leadership can start often at the bottom up. But then what does someone who understands the role of a leader do when they see that kind of movement taking hold?
Well, it's an interesting question. But let me say, first of all, Larry, how much I appreciate the fact that you've actually read the book. That's good. Well, let's go. And I want to go back to the great man theory just for a minute, if we could. There has been, and for a long time, in culture, especially in American culture, a sense that, you know, that if we've really got problems, somebody's going to come in on a white horse, and, you know, and pull a holster out in the West, and it's all going to be okay again, that one person can solve it. That in today's world, it is increasingly clear that progress comes through collaboration, constructive collaboration, which I write about in the book. And, you know, there's a woman, Patty Stonecipher, used to be, she was the first CEO of the Gates Foundation. And I remember how she told audiences, you know, that if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And I think that's a safe bit of advice. So collective and constructive collaboration, which you see increasingly because we're so interdependent, is good, but we still need the individuals like Zelensky who can step forward, who can inspire us. We need heroes in life. And, you know, frankly, I think one of the reasons we suffer today with so much anxiety about what's happening is we don't have many heroes we can sort of rely upon and feel secure. They make us feel secure. Zelensky sort of helps to normalize, has been helping to normalize life in Ukraine. And however it turns out, and we don't know yet at this conversation, however it turns out, I think he's going to go down as a statesman, obviously, but I think he has a chance to go down as a hero as well.
You say that today we need fresh thinking and fresh energy, and I couldn't agree with you more, but I want to go back to my generation. I'm part of the baby boom generation.
Uh-huh.
And
the villains.
The villains. Well, you talk about Black Lives Matter and the movement, you say, forced the country to confront its brutal past and present, unlike any grassroots effort before it. And yet I'm reading about states that are pushing back against what I consider the Black Lives Matter to be, which is asking us to put a mirror to ourselves and look honestly at where we've been and how far we still have to go.
I'm of the view that even though I don't agree with all the politics of Black Lives Matter or AOC, for example, that I think that we will look back at, from a point of view of history, and say, thank goodness we had people who were trying to bring additional change. They may even have been out of the mainstream, but it's really important to have people who argue the case for more change. I think the last thing we need to do as a country right now is settle back and saying how we live together right now is the new norm. This is not acceptable and it's not sustainable the way we're living together as a group for a very long period of time, which is just not sustainable. And so I do think it matters. And let me say one other thing about the collective and the constructive collaboration. Increasingly, that points to for activist groups like Black Lives Matter and Occupy Wall Street, that they have argued from the beginning, they don't want to have single heroic figures leading their organizations, because they so easily can be picked off. You know, after coming through the assassinations and other things, there's a real fear in the Black Lives Matter community about what might happen to somebody if they were the leader, if there was a leader. So they intentionally are looking for ways to create more and fuel more leadership and more active leadership coming from the bottom up. So you have some people who come from the top down, the leaders, but you have a growing effort at the community level. I stress the community level. In places like New Haven, for example, the town-town relationships are not only important, it's important what happens all across New Haven, the civic health of that city. I think cooperation and collaboration between the University at Yale and some other universities that are nearby with the leading lights of the state are what make for progress. Not just you need a Zelensky. He filled an incredibly important role, played an incredibly important role in Ukraine. But you also need local community activists where a lot of the real progress comes, or a lot of the failures come.
You say that great leaders know that even as you learn how to navigate in roiling waters, and of course they are tested most in crisis, that you must also hold firm to your true north. And you talk about true north a lot in the book. Help us to understand how in the midst of chaos and really complicated questions and really smart people advising you, but you really have to boil it down and remind yourself of your inner journey and your outer journey. You talk about that as well. Help us put all of that in perspective when we think about leadership.
It's a lot to discuss at one time, but let me introduce you to the primary thought, and that is that strong leaders, good leaders, are ones who have a set of values and principles by which they live. And you're not born with those. You a lot depends on what kind of upbringing you've had, how your parents, how well they loved you and how they set good standards for you. But eventually it comes down to you, the person who wants to have the responsibility for others, to serve others. It's really, really important that you develop a set of values when you're young, and when I say young, I'm talking about in your 20s or 30s. You and I are not as young as we might want, as we were at one point. But nonetheless, having a steady set of values and principles will help you a great deal in knowing how to navigate, because you can keep your eye on the far spot you're trying to gain, what's your goal, where you're trying to go. And what we found, Larry, and I write about in the book, is that people who have been through a lot of adversity, people who have experienced what we call crucibles in their lives, in many cases people have crucibles. These are moments when you just, terrible things happen to you. Some people just never get over adversity. Other people rally to it and are resilient. But there's a special brand of people that we like as leaders, and those are people who come through a crucible having defined their moral purpose in life with a clear sense of what they're trying to accomplish as a human being. It's almost, people on their deathbeds. There's this wonderful old story about W.C. Fields. Somebody walked in and W.C. Fields was on his deathbed, but he had a Bible out and he was going through it at a great clip. And the person who was the visitor said, "What are you doing? Where are you doing this?" And he said, and Fields said, "Looking for loopholes."
I love that. Well, you talk about courage and character as being prerequisites for great leadership. And it's really interesting because the last 4 years prior to the Biden presidency, we kept talking about a transactional presidency. And you say to us that, in fact, who could have imagined that our democracy might be on the brink of collapse? And that has to deal with those 4 years and that transactional presidency where morals, ideals, standards seem to really take a back seat to making a deal of some sort, whether it was for personal enrichment or for the benefit of the country.
Yeah, well, there's a great temptation, and I think for leaders, once they've sort of ascended into a place where they, they've had unusual success, the danger is that it goes to your head, and you don't stick to your values. You sort of think, well, I'm above the fray, and the rules don't apply to me. Bill Clinton, for all his many strengths, liked to walk on the edge, right on the edge of the envelope, because it was sort of exciting, it was interesting for him. But it got him into trouble. We've seen that happen with other leaders. My first president was Richard Nixon. I was coming out of the military and been working on draft reform, and out of nowhere was offered a job and took it for 1 year, Nixon White House. And by the way, my boss was a good Yalie, Ray Price. Yeah. But anyway, the point is that Nixon didn't have a true north either. And it got him into a lot of trouble. He was very transactional. And I think that I've been thinking about this a lot because, I'm trying to write this book and look at history and try to get some of the tales from history. I was very struck by a book by Barbara Tuchman, who was a wonderful historian, no longer with us, but in the 60s and 70s, she was a major historian with a lot of influence on Jack Kennedy. But she went back and examined how various societies and civilizations over the years had tried to prepare people for governance, for leadership, and running a society. I mean, every organization, every civilization, you have to train people up who can take on lives of service and leadership. And she, as she went through the civilization, she said, you know, the one thing that's apparent is that each one of them over time collapsed. Whether it might have been in Germany and Prussia, or whether it might be the Janissaries or the Chinese or others, their societies eventually collapsed. And she said the one thing that she had, the one thread that ran through all of the civilizations she looked at was, if you want to have good leaders, the first and most important thing you need to examine is not their policies, not their pledges, but their character. What kind of people are they? Can you depend on them? Are they going to be honest with you? Are they going to look out for others and not just their own pocketbooks, not just their own power trips? And that's what's so important now as we work with the younger generation. I think we're at a crossroads as a people. And we can go one of two ways. We can go the way we're going now, which isn't working, or we can remember people like the World War II generation, which was the generation that was in power when I first came to Washington. And I've got enormous nostalgia about those people who came through. This is the alternative path. And it was World War II generation we think of as people who came of age during the war. We had seven presidents, starting with Kennedy, and going through George H.W. Bush, seven presidents who every single one of them wore a military uniform. Six of them were in the war itself. One, Jimmy Carter, was still young. He was at the Naval Academy studying as a student when the war ended, and he went on to serve honorably as a submariner. But those seven presidents, you know, having fought under the same flag, were happy to work together back when they came home. You know, the political polarization that we see now was not as, just wasn't there in the same way. I have enormous regard for those people because they came back, they took off their uniform, stripped off their military uniforms, put on their civilian clothes and said, how can we help back here? And they built a great nation in the years that followed the war, when from Kennedy on through Bush, the World War II generation. They weren't perfect. They left us Vietnam. They left us Watergate. They left us so that we didn't make the progress we needed for women's rights and civil rights and even the environment. But overall, when they left the stage, the World War II generation, America was the strongest nation in the world, and had nobody ever seen anything like it since the Roman civilization, you know, in terms of cultural power, political power, economic power, military power. We were right up there at the top. We're no longer there. We're no longer playing that role we did with the World War II generation of providing leadership for the world itself. And that is what I think the choice we now have to make in the younger generations is, how are we going to proceed? Are we going to snap out of where we are now? We can do a lot better than this. One of the lessons you learn from history, and Abigail Adams famously wrote to her son, John Quincy Adams, mm-hmm. saying that adversity was what created great people. People who come through adversity and are still standing and have these, you know, have a true north in their lives, they're the people we look to providing leadership. And we have to encourage that within the younger generation. We have to encourage them to prepare themselves for service and lives of leadership and service. And the role of leaders is to serve others. So it's a very, very important lesson to bring out of this. And I just make one last point, Larry, and I'm happy to go. I'm sorry to talk so long.
No.
But I would make one last point. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book is that I have had a chance now to spend a lot of time with the younger generation. I've taught them in classrooms. I've tried to mentor them in their as they come out of the school. I've worked especially closely with young veterans coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq. And we tried to put fellowships out there. They can come to the Kennedy School at Harvard. We're doing a lot because I have found these veterans who are coming back are so much more refreshing. And so they give you spirit and they give you hope because they are like the World War II generation. They're not like what we've had in recent years. They are much more put together. And I've been very encouraged by the quality of people coming through. These young people, and some people now are becoming mayors of their cities in their 20s or early 30s. And if you look across the world, people in their 30s are doing a lot. It's never too early to start on a life of service and leadership.
I couldn't agree with you more. I've got to say this. By the way, the book is called Hearts Touch with Fire, How Great Leaders Are Made.
Let me tell you the story behind that.
Okay.
People ask me about, what is that title? What's that title all about? I said, well, you know, there's a man called Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr.
Mm,
his dad was a famous, medical doctor. His family went way back in history. It was a prominent family. And when Civil War came along, he could easily have ducked the war. He could have paid somebody and gotten out of it. But instead, Holmes, as a young man, dropped everything he was doing and signed up with the Massachusetts Regiment, went off to war, and he was grievously wounded 3 times in the Civil War. And the last time he was left for dead, but he managed to rise up from that. But in any event, the terrible suffering that he went through. But in the speech then 20 years later, he talked about what the meaning of that war had been for the people who fought in it. And he said, you know, in our heart, he described it as some people emerging from the war, elevated, with a sense of having, they had done something with real purpose. They had done something meaningful and they were very fulfilled by that. And he said, Holmes said to the audience, in our youth, that meant when he went back to the Civil War, in our youth, our hearts were touched with fire. And he talked about, you know, how they had drawn fulfillment from doing hard things. Someone once asked Mother Teresa, why would you spend so much time with people who are so poor, they're down and out, and, you know, it's almost impossible to lift them up. Why would you do that? And she said, because I wanted a hard life, because I wanted a hard life. And that's what Holmes was talking about, you know, welcoming a hard life. Yes, it may be difficult. But the people have done that. Look at Zelensky, as we just started the conversation about. He volunteered for what he's doing. And
no,
you know,
absolutely.
Putting his life on the line every day. Putting his life, you know he's a marked man.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things I was so impressed by, because I've had this argument, I think many of my boomer friends have gotten so cynical and they've lost their idealism, and you hold up idealism as a really important element to leadership.
Yes.
But you also are very complimentary of millennials and Gen Z and all that they are going through. My goodness, from 9/11 through to the crash back in 2009, to school shootings, to a pandemic, and now a war. I mean, it's remarkable. I think this is a great generation. And frankly, I don't think my generation, from a leadership standpoint, has really held its own. We had a lot of promise. We had a lot going in the 60s and the 70s, and something happened.
I totally agree. I'm so glad you made those arguments, and because I absolutely agree. I do think that the baby boom generation, I'm not exactly a baby boomer. I'm sort of a preemie, I associate a lot with the baby boom generation. And to the degree that that generation has made mistakes, I certainly share in my proportion of those mistakes. So, you know, I'm disappointed about the way we've come out as a generation, and I think we ought to spend our remaining years doing what we can to prepare others for the future. You know, we don't have long runways as we once did, but there is time, and I think there is a cry, there's a need to work with these younger generations. My experience with the millennials and Gen Z is exactly yours. They are, I find that they give me hope. Because I think their hearts are in the right place and they're trying hard. And yet they've had so many blows under their administration and their generation, going back to 9/11. And we've had two economic recessions that were very sharp. You know, we've had the climate problems. We've had dishonesty problems. We've had Watergate. We've had, you know, Donald Trump. This generation has gone through a lot. And yet they still hold out hope. They still want to go out there and fight for it. And that's what I think they need our help. and are recognizing their contributions and accepting the fact that they, on some issues, may be more liberal or more to the left and that sort of thing. That's okay when you're young. It's a healthy thing to, you know, to begin exploring other perspectives. So I call myself a short-term pessimist, but a long-term optimist.
I like that. What role do followers play in the efficacy of a leader? Because I am so tired, Mr. Gergen, of hearing people talking about the fact that, well, we have to satisfy our base, or I want to win this short-term victory, and therefore I will acquiesce to things that are outside the bounds of probity. I will agree to things, or I won't criticize, like Kevin McCarthy not criticizing some of the way out folks. That is intolerable to me. For some reason, I can't understand that.
I wish I could explain it. I do think it is a hunger for power as opposed to a hunger for sort of righteous or good model living. You're right. It is. I think it's become widespread. And what is not appreciated is the more we see of grifters who are coming into politics, and the more we see of these people with, you know, who are out for blood, the more we're going to have people lose trust in our institutions and lose trust in our leaders, and it becomes increasingly difficult to govern, and increasingly you begin to go the other way. That's the crossroads I think we're at. Which way are we going to go? And I do think there are millennials and there are Gen Zers who are pointing us in the right direction. We don't have enough of them. We need more, and we need to prepare more. Let me give you an example. I'm a big believer in national service. It's an idea that has been around for a long time. And conservatives like Bill Buckley, going back years and years ago, the Bill Buckley at Yale, was for national service. He wanted mandatory national service. I would prefer voluntary service. But what it would be to create a culture in which we encourage every young person, and it would be voluntary, to spend at least a year giving back to their community. And in exchange for that year, they would get a year's worth of tuition or knocked off their student debt. And they might stick around for a couple of years. There was in the Roosevelt time, FDR's time, something he came into the presidency in March of 1933. And that March or that April, he proposed the creation of a Civilian Conservation Corps, CCC. By that summer, there were 250,000 young men in the woods and forests of America in the CCC. They had a job. They were working together. People from different backgrounds, different faiths, different economic conditions, but they were all in those woods together. And it was one of the most popular, if not the most popular, program of the New Deal. It was a million served in it over time, and they came back stronger for it. They came back more dedicated to each other. You know, it made a real difference in the war. And when a Sultan Saul from Massachusetts wound up saluting a kid from Brooklyn, that's what gave us a sense of unity as a people. And we realized we're all in this together. And I think produced great results. So I'm persuaded that there are a growing number of young people, if we work with them, who can do one whale of a lot of good for the country going forward.
I can only imagine in Ukraine, when I see the people mobilizing these territorial brigades, can you imagine the leadership that they are going to have available to them that was touched with fire as they develop their democracy? It's going to be remarkable.
So true. So true. I mean, I hadn't made that connection, the touch with fire with the Ukrainian leadership that's emerging. It's a good point. You will hear it once again. I may write it down somewhere. And I probably won't give you enough credit.
No, that's okay. I love watching you on CNN. At the crux of it all, you say there's one central question. How great an impact can one person have on the arc of history? And I love the stories you told about Churchill and FDR. I didn't know them. We almost lost both of them.
Yes.
It was serendipitous that they survived to do what they had to do to save what we now enjoy.
Yes, you're so right. They're two of my favorite folks from history, and I must say Eleanor Roosevelt as well. I thought she played a significant and extraordinarily important role in opening doors for women and helping to get the suffrage and everything else. But, you know, that story I tell it, to some audiences about Roosevelt and Churchill, and saying that, you know, one of them came to, one politician, British politician, came to America, was in New York City, was out for dinner, got out of the cab on the wrong side, and was hit by an car next to him, almost killed him. And 14 months later, another politician, this one an American, was sitting in an open car in Miami when a gunman fired at him at point blank range. Had it not been for a woman who jarred the arm of the gunman, he would have died. Instead, the bullet killed the person sitting next to him. Yeah, and so the question is, would history have been any different if that man in New York, that British politician, Winston Churchill, had died that night? And would the history have been any different if that other politician in Miami, Franklin Roosevelt, had died in that car in Miami? And all the historians who look at that question, starting with Arthur Schlesinger Jr., it reached the unanimous conclusion that whatever else you may say about leadership, the outcome in history would have been different without Churchill, without Roosevelt, that we were lucky to have them. So when the Zelenskys of the world come forward, we should celebrate them and support them and recognize they're precious for our democracies.
Well, you also point to TR, and you had great respect for him, Teddy Roosevelt, the man in the arena. That is a classic speech that he gave. Let me ask you about leadership in closing, because you've given me generously your time. It starts from within. Important to know how the world works. But even more important, you say, is to learn how you work. And I think that's so important a concept.
What I've tried to do in the book is to develop this idea that a leader, an emerging leader, is on a journey. And it's a journey that lasts a lifetime. But it starts with what's going on inside you. You can't serve others until you can serve yourself and lead yourself. And so it starts with self-understanding and self-mastery. You have to understand who you are, your strengths and your weaknesses, and then decide what you're going to build on to develop your North Star. And paradoxically, sometimes it's better to start with changing your strengths, evolving your strengths, than working on your weaknesses. Peter Drucker, who was a celebrated guru for business CEOs, used to argue that it was far better to go from good to great than to go from mediocre to good. So you ought to develop a couple of strengths that are really powerful, and then be good across the board in a more general way. But develop strengths that are more powerful. Very importantly, is this whole notion of self-mastery, and that is to look at yourself in an honest, brave way, and say, you know, am I doing right by the people I work with? Am I doing right by the people I live with? And what do I need to bring my to deal with my weaknesses? To go back to Nixon, Nixon was the best strategist I've ever met in public life. But he had demons inside him, and he had never learned to control those demons. And that's what brought him down. When David Frost interviewed him toward the end of after Nixon had left office, and Frost asked him, "What the hell happened?" And Nixon said, "I gave my enemies a sword, and then they ran me through." And that is exactly what happened. He brought it on himself, and he handed his enemies a sword, and he went down. And so it's really important to begin your journey inside and to get yourself under control as a human being. And then it's important from that to start, as you grow older, to mix with the outside world, to rub shoulders with the world, so to speak, and develop your skills, your social skills, and your intellectual skills. And then to bring that outer journey, inner journey, and that outer journey together in action. As your leader, your place in the world is not under a lamp in a library. Your place in the world is in the arena, as Teddy Roosevelt said, to be that person in the arena who's willing to make the great fight, because it's really, really important. And there's story after story that I've been happy to sort of publish and bring to people's attention, like the story of Rachel Carson, for example, or John Lewis, or so many other people we could talk about, that they give us inspiration. You can't change the world, but you can contribute to the world, and you can make a difference in the world. Individuals can do that, and you can make a surprising difference. And it starts in your community. It starts within you, and it spreads to your community. You know, you don't have to be in the White House to be a good leader. You don't have to be, you know, a bishop. You don't have to do other things. Like, you don't have to be to tip top. What you have to have is a good heart and a willingness to put it to use.
What I think this book does, it gives us all something that we can take away as we're thinking about what role we are playing in this world. For real leaders of countries, you talk about the booster rockets. Reading of history is important, humor, and then you talked about an integrated life, and I thank you for explaining what that meant when the inner journey and the outer journey come together. And by the way, folks, I haven't even mentioned the executive summary at the end, 20 key takeaways. So this is in some ways a how-to book, but more importantly, yes, it gives you a philosophical framework to think about the concept of leadership. Heart touch with fire. David Gergen, what an honor to have you with us today on America Trends. Thank you so much.
Listen, you're the leader. You've done a great job. I appreciate being on here, and thank you. Thank you again for reading the book. I'm inspired.
Oh, thank you so much for writing it, and thank you for being with us today.